Hello and welcome to the programme. Well, the country is still in lockdown, so once again, I'm pre-recording this programme from my back garden in South Dublin. Dr. Richard Collins is in Malahide in North County Dublin. We'll be joining Richard shortly, but first, I want to draw your attention to a video that we have posted on our website. It's rte.ie/Mooney, and it's fair to say it's not for the faint-hearted because, frankly, it depicts the carnage left after what is believed to have been an attack on a pair of nesting mute swans on the Royal Canal in Dublin 7 by a dog. The report was sent by John Seary, who lives in the area. Now, I must say at this point that last week John emailed me a beautiful picture of a pair of very house-proud mute swans at the nest site, but he was keen to add some moving images, so John went to record the swans on his mobile phone. Only when he arrived back at the nest site on Tuesday last, he was shocked at what he found. Have a listen to the audio and then we'll ask Richard for his opinion.
Hi Derek, I'm just off the Whitford Road here at the Royal Canal in sunny North Dublin, and as you can see a particular swan here in the distance. I think this is the same swan that built a nest right behind me. But unfortunately today when I came back to the same spot while out walking, doing my maximum 2k walk, I came across a load of feathers and also the actual nest itself being abandoned. Now, the further I looked at the swan feathers over here, I noticed there were some speckles of blood around them. And the guard just a few moments ago just told me that the swan seems to have been attacked by a dog. Firstly, I would have thought that a swan was more of a match for a dog than most birds, but obviously some damage has obviously happened to the poor creature. I think the female is still there. I don't know if that is the same bird. Definitely there was two of them a few days ago, but unfortunately it seems that the nest itself, either it's abandoned or it's been just left vacant for a while, but that's what they made up in the past few days. And again, there's more feathers there, which is quite unfortunate. So firstly, is it normal to see a swan's nest so far away from a canal bank? To me, it seems very far. And the second question is, would they be a match for doggers? Is this quite common? I mean, I thought swans were very adept at defending themselves. Thanks a million.
Now, I've seen this a few times. I can only describe those images as disturbing. There is clear evidence that someone or something attacked the swans on the riverbank. Anyways, you probably know by now, Dr. Richard Collins is our swan expert. Richard did his PhD on population dynamics on mute swans here in Ireland, so he's very familiar with the swans on our canals. Richard, you've seen John's video. What have you got to say?
Well, I think it's a disgrace, really, that somebody presumably set a dog on those swans, because swan is a formidable character. Your ordinary dog that happens along, if he went close to the nest, the swan would rear up the one on the nest, and the cob, the male, would come in and rear up as well. And believe you me, they are frightening creatures, and they will fight, and they will hit that dog with their carpal joint of the wing, and if he goes in the water, they'll jump on top of him and try to push him under. No, it would take the brave dog that would do that. It must have been a large, a rather vicious dog, and I think it must have been set on those swans. They would then, of course, escape onto the water after a tussle, which explains why you have feathers there with blood on them, but the swans themselves escape. The dog wouldn't follow them onto the water. The mysterious thing, of course, is where did the eggs go? Did whoever was with the swan, did he take the eggs? I wonder what happened there. It's an offence what has happened, clearly, because you are required to keep your dog under control. And if your dog does damage, you are responsible for that damage. I think there has been a breach of the law. I know these swans. They nest there every year, have done so for years. Of course, I'm not entirely sure it's the same ones, but I believe it is. Now, interestingly, the birds that nested there became very accustomed to people, very tame, if you like. They're familiar with people and to some extent with dogs. They would not be afraid of a dog because they encounter them all the time. Now, most years they manage to get off some young, several on some occasions. And usually swans nesting in big cities are fairly safe because there's lots of people around. So anyone who is bent on vandalism isn't going to attack a swan's nest because he's likely to be reported. People will notice him and tell the guards about him. So this is a strange incident. It's an unusual incident. And all the causes of mortality I recorded, hundreds of them in all those years ago when I studied swans, I didn't find any that I could definitely attribute to a dog. So the likelihood is that both swans got away. They will live to breed another day, hopefully.
But will they breed, Richard? Will an incident like this not scare the living you-know-what out of them?
No, Derek, it won't. Swans are tough characters. They're resilient characters. And I've known them to go through dreadful ordeals and covered in blood at the end of falling into a lock gate and having to be dragged up, that kind of thing. And yet they go on to breed the following year. Now, they're unlikely to go back to the immediate vicinity of that nest. They will nest somewhere else along the stretch, but I believe they will nest successfully. Now, John raised an interesting question there. How far away should the nest be from water? It is quite far, I think, from the video, I would say maybe 10, 12 metres. Now, that is a bit unusual. Swans like to nest right on the water or even floating slightly on the water, but they do sometimes nest a little bit away, and this is a case where they've done that. Knowing that stretch of the canal, I walk it sometimes, there aren't many places right near the water where you could easily place a nest. There's not much vegetation, no reeds and things like that. So they have to choose a place that's got a bit of shelter. So they went over to the wall there and the fence behind it because the wind wouldn't get at them there. So I suspect they went over there, and they're quite used to people, so they didn't worry too much about security, perhaps. They're lulled into a sense of false security, maybe. But they will come back next year and they will nest somewhere along that stretch.
Thanks, Richard. We'll talk to you shortly. We have a report coming up later in the programme from Richard about a book called Nature's Explorers, which I think you'll find very interesting. I'm joined now by Terry Flanagan, who is in Clonsilla in Dublin 15 and from his home in County Wicklow, Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland. Niall, you've seen this video also.
I have, and it is very distressing stuff. The swan seems to have survived, probably. There's a picture, at least, of one of the swans over the other side approaching some people, maybe looking for food. But there's piles of feathers, the feathers are bloodstained, and the nest has been deserted. So it looks like it was a pretty unpleasant attack on these birds at a very vulnerable time. Certainly, swans would try to hold their own against a dog, especially when they're defending a nest, which is why they can be...
As Richard was saying,
yeah,
yes.
Absolutely, which is why they can be so badly injured, because if it was not the nest time, that the swan would probably just retreat and would get into the water and leave the dog as quickly as it could. But when it's trying to protect its mate or protect the nest, they can be very, very, very vulnerable. A swan is a formidable creature, but it wouldn't be a match for a big dog that could certainly do some damage. Sometimes the shoe can be in the other foot. There was reports last year of a situation where a swan actually killed a dog, unfortunately, in a park where the dog went swimming over towards it and the swan actually drowned it. But on land, it would usually be the dog that wins. It's obviously very important that people keep dogs under control. It's actually a criminal offence to allow a dog to attack nesting birds. So that's an important element in this as well. Hopefully that pair will recover and will be able to re-nest. Again, where they chose was a nice sheltered location, but maybe they'll be all put off now by what happened.
This is the peak breeding season for birds now.
It absolutely is, and it's when they're at their most vulnerable, because even though the adult birds are vulnerable enough, they kind of know the ropes at this stage, but they're very protective of their chicks, who are much more naive. And this is when a lot of young fledglings are starting to leave the nest. I've had some drama with this myself in my back garden today, involving a cat. A local brood of blackbirds fledged today, lovely to see them, but one of the little youngsters was up on my neighbour's shed roof just at the back of my garden, and then I could see all of a sudden this black and white cat just prowling towards it. I went and shooed the cat away, and luckily the little blackbird jumped into the ivy on my back wall, where its mother has been coming and bringing it food and has been calling to it constantly all day. I still keep having to chase the cat away. It keeps coming back every few minutes and trying to find that little blackbird, which is still, for the last few hours, has just been sitting in the ivy. The mother is constantly calling this distress call to warn the chick to lie low, and hopefully it'll survive. But it's an important time of year to make sure to keep your cats in, if at all possible. Cats can wreak havoc on bird populations, especially when the young are so naive and vulnerable at the moment and not so able to fly. It's something that we need to bear in mind. Actually, I just see the male and the female blackbird are now perched up above the ivy right now, looking down where the chick is. So it still seems to be surviving for the moment, at least.
Well, we're always saying bell the cat, and I'm going to say today, lead the dog.
Absolutely.
You know, get your act together, guys. If you're in a park and you're near a pond, you're near birds, put the lead on the dog. You should have a lead on the dog anyway. There's only certain hours of the day when you're allowed to let your dog off the lead. And they're going to be scaring the life out of the bird, so be careful. Now, Terry Flanagan, you're in Clonsilla in your back garden. Terry, you walk your dog, do you not? Do you have it on the lead?
Absolutely, all the time. But she's a young dog and really she's not cute enough yet to let off the lead. But I go up the canal every day and there are swans up the canal. She just looks at them. She doesn't go near them at all. Could I just go back to that piece, that distressing piece of video there, Derek, as well? Because it looked like the nest was over beside a railing, which is really unusual because swans usually nest on the water or literally right beside the water. This appears to have been a very, very unusual nest site, as if it was maybe a pair of young birds. And really in a situation like that, what I think people, if they see something like that, certainly don't try and move it. But what people can do is they can get onto their local county council, wherever it is, Dublin City Council, Fingal County Council in my case here, and just ask the council, would they come out and put a barrier around it just to give some kind of protection?
Now, I want to talk to you about blackbirds, Terry, because Niall was mentioning blackbirds in his garden, and we have another video sent in to us, this time from a gentleman by the name of Robbie, and it has to do with blackbirds, or a blackbird that was nesting in his garden but seems to have disappeared.
Hi, Derek. My name is Robbie Hoyland. I'm from Lucan. I was wondering, could you solve a problem with a blackbird that has been building a nest in my back garden? We were watching him for a few weeks and he was gathering moss and bits and pieces in the garden, and he eventually made his nest just behind a jasmine plant. We were watching him going in and out for about 2 weeks, and I was in the back garden one morning and I noticed he hadn't been in the nest. So I decided to take a video of the nest. So I just reached in quite quickly and took the video and came back away from it. I noticed that in the video we had 4 blue eggs. So over the next few days he was coming and going. But then all of a sudden, the last 2 days, he hasn't come back. I was just wondering, has he abandoned the nest, or would you be able to tell me exactly what happened? Thanks, Derek. Bye-bye.
Now, Terry, you're our blackbird man. You made a documentary last year about the blackbird for us. What do you think?
Well, it's sad to see it. That's the first thing I've got to say. But when you think of a blackbird, or you think of any bird, for life in general for them, they've got really 4 concerns. Food, water, reproduction and survival. And they will abandon a nest to survive. That's the first thing. Now, in general, I'm not talking about this particular video to start with, but in general, if you come across a nest, you'd have to say to yourself, has it actually been abandoned? If there's no eggs in it. You know, birds only build nests for eggs. And once the young have fledged, then everyone's going to leave that nest and they will rebuild new nests, maybe up to 3 times in the one season. So you're going to see a lot of empty nests to start with. And blackbirds, I know most people think of wrens for this, but in the case of blackbirds, and I'm sure Niall would agree, often build 2 nests at the one time. So you're going to see nests, first of all. So, why would they abandon it? For various reasons. They might feel threatened. A danger, or noisy children, pets, maybe a wasp's nest or a hornet's nest, or if there's a shed somewhere nearby and people are in and out cutting the grass and they're doing things like that. There are various reasons why birds may abandon a nest. But in this case, this nest, it was completed and there was eggs laid in it. So what do I think happened?
4.
Yeah, I saw them. Beautiful. And definitely blackbird's eggs, all right. So what happened? Well, it could be any one of maybe 4 things. A cat. You know, cats take a lot of birds, so may have taken the adult or the female bird. And remember, it's only the female that's going to incubate. So if the mammy's taken away, there's no one to come and sit on the eggs. Maybe the bird is hit by a car. How many times this time of the year do you actually see blackbirds flying low across the road from one feeding place
to another? Well, actually, less and less right now, Terry, in fairness.
Well, because
there's not that many cars on the road.
Well, okay, what about hawks then? There's plenty of hawks out there still. What about a window, flying into a window? I've seen that a number of times as well. So I would think more than likely it was probably that the female was taken probably by a cat or a hawk or flying into a window or something like that. Of course, remember when they build nests, it takes a lot of energy to build a nest and it takes a lot of energy to lay those eggs. So the more energy that the female puts into the whole nesting procedure, the less likely she is to abandon it. So in this case, she's already laid eggs. It's not really mm-hmm. what she would like to do. It's not the norm for her to abandon a nest now.
No.
It would be she would want to continue this clutch on. So I would say, sadly, something probably happened to the mammal.
Oh, no, no, oh, yes. No, that's not what I want to hear on this beautiful evening. Anyway, truth. Can I just... Yes, is it that you, Niall? Are you saying something?
Sorry, just concurring. That's absolutely right. I think that something untoward happened to this female because she, you know, abandoned or seemingly abandoned the eggs or left them unprotected. Just to say though that it isn't unusual when birds are still in the process of laying to find a nest that still has some eggs in it without a bird sitting on them, because usually the birds won't start to incubate until all the eggs have been laid, and the female generally lays one egg a day. So that's normal enough. But in this case, it's been too long without the female coming back. So unfortunately, I think Terry's right. I think something untoward's happened to her.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Robbie, but if you want to learn more about blackbirds, Robbie and anybody else listening, we're going to post Terry's blackbird documentary. We may even broadcast it again in the coming weeks, but it's right now on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Mm-hmm. After tonight's programme, you can go there and you can listen to the most wonderful documentary about the blackbird. Now, Niall, you want to mention Spring Alive. What's all this about?
Around this time every year, we promote a project called Spring Alive on the programme. So Spring Alive, it's a scheme that Birdwatch Ireland takes part in, but not just Birdwatch Ireland. In conjunction with BirdLife International and with Heidelberg Cement, we run it in 40 countries around the world, throughout Africa, Europe and Central Asia. And what we do is we ask people to keep an eye out for their first of several different migrant species throughout the year. So it's the swift, the swallow, the cuckoo, the sand martin, and then this year as well we've added the ringed plover, which is in Ireland year round, but we also do get migratory visitors, and in Africa that's an important migratory species. And when people see or hear their first of any of those, you just go to springalive.net and log it there. And also on the Spring Alive website, there's loads of resources and games for children. Any children who are currently a bit bored looking for something to do at home, they can learn all about bird migration. It's a great family activity, and you can also see real-time maps of these birds as they're moving towards Ireland. So this is around the time of year when people might start hearing their first cuckoo, and because of the current restrictions there's less traffic around. I'm predicting that the cuckoo's song will travel further and more people than usual might hear them, even in some quite built up areas, I would expect. So that'd be really interesting particularly to see. So swift, swallows, cuckoos, sand martins and ringed plovers, springalive.net.
And the details on the website as well. And can I just mention that next Sunday will be International Dawn Chorus Day. And if you're a regular listener to the programme, you'll know that the live broadcast has been cancelled. But we do have a pre-recorded 1 hour sample, if you want, of the Dawn Chorus from Kuskany Marsh Nature Reserve in Cove, which was made last year. And you'll be able to hear that next Sunday morning on RTE Radio 1. And then this day week, we have a nationwide nature quiz. So what we're asking you to do is sit by your radio next week with the entire family and take part in the Mooney Goes Wild nationwide nature quiz. It couldn't be simpler. There will be 5 rounds, 5 questions per round, and a good mix of questions, different levels. You will be able to play along. We'll also give the answers in the evening, but you will have to appoint one person to be in charge, your scrutineer there in your home. So you've got to play by the rules. There's no prize for this. I just want to say it's just the taking part that counts. Now, there are few tales which capture our childhood imaginations better than those of the great explorers, be it the extraordinary journey into the wilds of interior Africa by David Livingstone. Dr. Livingstone, I presume, stepping out of the jungle gloom into the midday sun. What did you find there? Did you stand around and stare? Did you meet anyone? Do you know that song, Niall?
I do. I was thinking it was such a shame that the Eurovision Song Contest was cancelled this year, but you've more than made up for it with that. That's the best performance I've heard all year.
The Moody Blues, that goes back. We need a Brian Lely, Rengus McAnally here, people who are really old who'd remember that song. But that's Dr. Livingstone, I presume, is the name of that song. What was Dr. Livingstone doing in Africa, do you know? Can you tell me?
I can. He did many things, but he was a Christian missionary and anti-slavery campaigner who was also obsessed with trying to find the source of the River Nile. So he was going all over Africa trying to find this. He found some of the feeder waters of the Congo as well. And he got very lost when he was doing this. So for a period of 6 years, he disappeared in the deepest jungles. There was no communication for him. And it became a bit of a celebrity case all around the world for people wondering what had happened to him. Was he still alive? So Stanley, of course, famously went out and eventually tracked him down near the shores of Lake Tanganyika in Tanzania and uttered the famous lines, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. And apparently it was very strange because they had this very British reserve, and they wanted to embrace each other but couldn't, because the two gentlemen couldn't do that. So it was all very reserved, but apparently that's what happened. So, yeah, that's what he was up to.
Well, Livingstone, Shackleton, Amundsen, Scott, when you think of these pioneers, we tend to think of the superhuman extremes to which they went to map new worlds, discover new territories, claim previously unseen lands. We tend to think less of their academic companions and how they collected and recorded species unknown to science. These illustrators, painters and naturalists helped illuminate and colour the age of enlightenment and scientific revolution. A new book celebrates these individuals. It's called Nature's Explorers, Adventurers Who Recorded the Wonders of the Natural World. It's published by London's Natural History Museum, and it was there before the coronavirus COVID-19 pandemic took hold that Richard Collins met with Paul Martin Cooper, Special Collections Librarian at the Natural History Museum, and he wrote the chapter on illustrator Ferdinand Bauer, who travelled on Matthew Flinders' expedition to Australia.
Mind the gap, please.
Ferdinand Bauer was born 1760, lived until 1826, and he, with his brother, actually produced quite similar work, but they've been described as the greatest botanical artists there have been. So they were born around the time of Linnaeus, who devised the system of classification, effectively still in use today. Ferdinand made drawings of plants and to an extent of animals that were both scientifically accurate but also very beautiful. That successful merging of those two requirements was especially praised by Johann von Goethe at the time. So we have in our collection a large series of watercolour drawings by Ferdinand Bauer. Also, in fact, botanical specimens which he collected alongside the botanist Robert Brown from the great voyage that Bauer joined in with on the Investigator to Australia. That was 1801-1805.
So, Paul, you have two men, brothers. One stays at home and has an easy life, 9 to 5, humdrum. No great problems, no great stress. And the other goes off to the South Seas at a time when that must have been highly dangerous, in old wooden ships, totally unpredictable, dreadful food, no defence against diseases, no one to rescue, no lifeboat, no helicopter, nothing. It must have taken enormous courage to do that. How bad was it and how risky was it?
It's a very good point. Ferdinand Bauer would have been very aware, for example, of the first voyage of Captain Cook on the Endeavour to the South Pacific, so the same destination. And on that voyage, there were many losses of life, particularly following on from the final staging point, at that time called Batavia, now Jakarta in Indonesia. Well, it was well known to be a plague site, and indeed many of the sailors on board fell ill and died either there or on the return voyage to England. So my feeling is with Ferdinand Bauer that notwithstanding those kinds of possible problems, fears he might have had about the many things that could go wrong, he was nevertheless unable to resist the sense of adventure, which probably the best way of thinking about it is going to Australia at that time must have been a little bit like we hear nowadays about proposed tourist trips to the moon. Well, they haven't quite yet happened, but I think more or less it would have been on that kind of scale. And I think then, as now, a fascination with nature will go hand in hand with the desire to travel, because you know that at that far-off point you wish to go to, you're going to see and be able to study plants or animals that will be very, very different to what you're used to at home.
Well, now you mentioned Captain Cook, and Cook, of course, started out as a mere Lieutenant Cook, you know, and his voyage departed without any great tension. Yet, after his voyage, he becomes Captain Cook, he becomes the world's greatest explorer. He's made by it, and others kind of live out in his shadows because they're brought up. I mean, our good friend Banks is brought up by this. Is Boyer looking like that and saying, well, you know, if I go on one of these voyages, I would hit the jackpot, just like Banks did before me. And Banks has recommended him, I think, for this with the Flinders exhibition anyway. So there's a kind of habit of going out to make your name out there. You have to be a driven person. You're inside his head. You're his biographer, in a sense. Mm. Now, was he a driven person seeking fame, seeking advancement?
I feel there was like a double-sidedness to the way in which he was able to participate. So he had great draftsman and artistic skills that made him suitable to join in with such a voyage. So he wasn't responsible for the navigation, for example. He was able to sail alongside others who had that particular responsibility. I mean, he was a leader in his field of illustration and picked out by the great patron of science and voyaging, Joseph Banks. But there could be downsides. So my sense is that he would have very much enjoyed the voyage, then the circumnavigation of Australia, painting as he went along, helping to collect specimens. So a very kind of busy and intense time. And then there was a challenging return to Britain, sailing on the Investigator, which was not the most seaworthy vessel, even from the word go. But I guess it went with the job. So following the return to England, he had a great portfolio of mainly pencil drawings with very detailed notes. He used a numerical system to indicate precisely what colour, what shade this or that plant needed to be worked up into as a finished drawing. So he was engaged in that for a number of years in London, living in a house close to the home of Joseph Banks in Soho Square. But I think what kind of riled him a bit was that Banks really kind of breathed down his neck as Ferdinand completed this work. Banks wanted to make sure that it was done to his satisfaction, you know, according to his rules. And at one stage, Ferdinand removed some of his pencil drawings, which actually belonged not to Ferdinand himself. They weren't, he'd made them, but they weren't his personal property. He'd been an employee of the Admiralty during that voyage, so they really belonged to the Admiralty. But Banks was allowed to store them in his house. Anyway, at one point, Ferdinand removed a number of the drawings to his own property, fairly nearby in Bloomsbury. And as soon as Banks realized this, he demanded that Ferdinand return them to his house. So there were lots of constraints. I mean, certainly, you know, these are wonderful images that were produced following the return to London, but in quite difficult circumstances, in a sense.
But did he get fame after the journey, which is part of the question Richard is asking? And then what I want to know is, who decided what they collected? I mean, they couldn't take everything back. And did they know what they were taking back? Did any of this stuff have a name before they collected it, illustrated it, documented it, and then brought it back? And then when did it get its name?
Yeah. Decisions about what to collect, what to draw. I mean, this was a very large, diverse flora. Those decisions were made by the botanist Robert Brown. So there was some knowledge of the Australian natural history. For example, the time that Cook and Banks had spent at Botany Bay was very short. They scarcely went inland at all. But Brown had some knowledge, and the process of naming plants seen or collected on the Cook voyages had been very slow. So there was much work still to do following the return to England by Brown and subsequently others. But an awful lot of that material would have been named by Robert Brown.
When they returned?
Yes. And there were the circumstances to, you know, examine the specimens carefully, compare them to other specimens, particularly in the herbarium that Joseph Banks had. And he, Banks, was very generous to Brown and others in terms of making his existing collections available to them. So it was a very important, informal, but very valuable resource that he had within his private house.
You mentioned names, Paul. I understand from your chapter in the book that he wasn't a great self-promoter, but there is a Cape Bower in Australia, and there's also a Jenis Bower, I believe. That's odd, in a way. Here's a man who's very adventurous, who's doing the most hair-raisingly difficult and dangerous things, and yet he's kind of shy. He comes across as a kind of backrooms man, the kind of fellow who likes to be on his own in the corner doing his drawings and not pushing himself at all. There's kind of a contradiction there, is there?
Yes, I think that there was a kind of hierarchy that operated in the pursuit and study of natural history at that time. So the botanical artist would have ranked as quite lowly, and asserting himself wouldn't necessarily have been very welcomed. He did actually finally really lose patience with the whole setup. As we said, he completed many watercolour drawings back in London, and the expectation had been naturally that these would be published in one or more books. Actually, it quickly became clear that only a very small selection were going to be published in a work by Robert Brown, and one other work, an overall account of that voyage to Australia, written by Matthew Flinders, which he completed literally just before his death in 1815. And so I think Bower was left with a sense of frustration. And yes, perhaps he hoped that his name would become better known if many, many beautiful colour plates were published bearing his name. So he actually, in 1815, decided to return to Austria, where he was born, and to continue life as a natural history artist and illustrator there, and actually did rather well, and was a relatively well-off man by the time of his death.
And what would you say today, looking back on the work that he did and examining it now, was his contribution to our understanding of natural sciences?
I think the importance of his role didn't really emerge at that time. And both he and his brother, outstanding botanical artists, the turn of the 18th century, early 19th century, were really almost entirely forgotten during the rest of the 19th century. Actually, a great turning point in reassessing their work, both from an artistic and point of view and how it helped to contribute to science, came in the 1950s with the publication of a work on the history of botanical illustration by the late William Stern, who was a botanist at the Natural History Museum, also one-time librarian of the Royal Horticultural Society. So he produced a history with Wilfrid Blunt, a historian of botany. So this included examples of the painting of Ferdinand Bower. And really, since that time, there have been a number of monographs published on their work. And two botanists in the last couple of decades spent a great deal of time re-looking at their work, at the botanical specimens that Ferdinand Bower was helped to collect. So happily, over 200 years later, those two brothers, Franz and Ferdinand Bower, have been given a much fairer assessment.
He didn't invent the colour coding system, but he seems to have been the one who really used it and put it forward and developed it. Is that a major contribution?
Yeah, I think those two brothers were unusual for the extent to which they used it. I mean, it was something along those lines, but to a lesser extent was used, for example, by Sidney Parkinson on Captain Cook's first voyage. And it would be like an obvious thing to do. Imagine you're working, collecting in a difficult terrain, and it's hard to make much more than a sketch. And in order to keep a precise memory of the colour of this or that plant, it would be sensible to make notes. But the two Bauer brothers, who were trained from their youth in taking that approach, particularly Ferdinand, because he travelled a great deal, he developed it as a really important part of his methodology. And it's thought ultimately on that Australian trip on the Investigator, he used a code of maybe towards 1,000 letters combined with numbers, which made perfect sense to him when he got back to London.
For example?
When Ferdinand first used that methodology, but on a small scale with maybe, say, 100 numbers corresponding to different colours, different shades, he would also have used a colour chart, a little bit what you might pick up in a decorator's shop to help you choose which colour to paint your kitchen walls. But I think as he developed that, he probably had, you know, a knowledge more in his mind of the sort of total palette that he would use. And but perhaps in the wider artistic field around that time, I mean, there was a lot of interest in colour nomenclature, and those names like Madder Brown were developed about that time. So colour and the naming of colours was of great developing interest at that time.
If you went into the field with him, would he be carrying a chart of some kind or a little booklet of colours with the codes? And would he come to a flower and look at the petal and take out the chart and see which one matched it and then write down in his notebook it's Q67 or something like this?
No. Unfortunately, there isn't much surviving documentary evidence that he would have had, obviously, beside his paper for drawing on, some kind of notebook that he would constantly refer to, and you know, which would never leave his side. But there is actually one surviving document of that type, which is now in the Botanic Garden at Madrid in Spain, and this is quite a small scale manuscript with examples of colours with numbers alongside them, which actually was used by a Spanish navigator thought to have acquired it from either from the Bowers or via an intermediary, and had reused it and came to be in that botanic garden. So, yeah, the kind of thing that could easily have been lost, thrown away. So that is an interesting survival, demonstrating the kind of way that Bauer worked.
It would also presumably have been a defence against the decay of paper. Paper would be very vulnerable to dampness and drying out even, or all kinds of problems. So if you produced paintings on paper, they would degrade over time, I suppose, in the heat and the humidity and so forth. But if you had a colour-coded account written down in numbers, kind of digital version of what you were depicting, it would help to survive that. Or is there any sense in which he was protecting himself against the vulnerability of his materials?
It's a very good point, because this seems to be precisely the problem that Ferdinand experienced, particularly sailing around the northern coast of Australia in the tropics. In one of the few surviving letters to his brother back in London, France, he complained of mould which was affecting his supply of paper for drawing on to be used. And he told his brother that because of the damp, there were mould spots on it, and so he couldn't use it. In any circumstances, paper would have been a precious resource, so this was a challenge. But I guess helped because he knew that he would make final finished watercolours back in England with, of course, a new great supply of paper.
And details of how you can get your hands on a copy of that book, and a fascinating book it is too, and a great insight you got there, rte.ie/Mooney. While you're there, have a look at the ducklings video that I made last Monday in Balls Bridge when I saw a Garda escorting 8 ducklings and the mallard mom across the road. She flew into the River Dodder and the ducklings stayed on the bridge. They wouldn't go down. She was calling, calling, calling. They were chirping, chirping, chirping. Eventually the Garda grabbed handfuls of the ducklings and threw them over the bridge into the water. And kind of people were looking kind of slightly horrified, but he knew what he was doing, this guard. Fair play to him. He had done it before, he subsequently told me. But at any rate, they floated and they landed on the water and they were all reunited and they all made it. But Niall, you put the video on the Birdwatch Ireland Facebook page and it got massive traffic.
Oh, absolutely, and it's still going. So when I'm talking to you now, it has almost 100,000 views. It's been shared over 1,000 times. People really love this video, and I can see why. It's absolutely charming. A lot of people have been putting comments underneath, hoping that it all worked out well, because the video doesn't show the actual reunification of the mother with her ducklings. But we've been reassuring them that, don't worry, everything's fine. It's all worked out well.
Oh, that's my fault. Did I not send you that? That is on the on our website, rte.ie/mini. No, I have the video of the eight ducklings and the mom together in the water, happy out.
Great stuff. Yeah, well, people really enjoy it. I think it's one of those kind of feel-good things we all need at the moment. And fair play to the guard. He knew what he was doing.
Well, do you want to explain what was going on? Because I didn't give any commentary on the video.
So mallards have this seemingly strange habit of nesting well away from water. The mother who raises the chicks and incubates eggs entirely by herself, the male has no role in that. She wants to get as far away from other ducks as possible, particularly the males. So she'll often actually build her nest somewhere, maybe leaf litter under some trees or in a park or something like that. And then when the ducklings hatch out, as soon as they hatch out, they're already very mobile. They feed themselves from day one. The mother never actually has to feed them, but she'll lead them to water because it's much safer them to be in water at that stage when they've hatched out. No doubt what was happening there was that these ducks, the ducklings had set off after their mother, who was leading them along down the street towards the bridge to get into the water. Of course, she knows what she's doing, but for the ducklings, they're only a few minutes old probably, so they don't really know what's going on. There's a bit in the video where I was a bit worried one of them was going to fall down the drain at the side of the road, but the guard was on top of that and everything was fine. They were marching along, and then in the video you can see the female just sort of jumps off the bridge down into the water. It's quite a long drop, and the little ducklings don't really know what's going on, which is obviously where the guard stepped in. They were quite lucky, I suppose, that there was far less traffic than there normally would have been. But I think that a lot of people around Irish cities are kind of used to this happening this time of year, and everyone is sort of very indulgent of the little duck family going across the road. I don't think anyone begrudges them holding up the traffic for a few minutes to allow that to happen. It's a really charming little thing to see.
Mm.
Do you remember, Derek, a few years ago there was a mother mallard who nested in a really bad location in RTE, in one of the courtyards between the buildings. She could fly in obviously from above, but there was no route for her to get outside, and she obviously didn't think ahead that her ducklings wouldn't be able to fly out and join her. And so there's a lot of consternation and everyone was wondering what to do. So we were joined by my Birdwatch Ireland colleague Ricky Whelan, who came, and he helped us catch the ducks, and we took them over to Herbert Park, and everything went very well. But it was it was very strange. There's no accounting sometimes for how these females choose to nest. It was obviously a very silly location that time.
Well, my hat off to that Garda who helped those ducks. He did the right thing and he knew what he was doing. He said he'd done it many times before. Anyway, Terry, you want to tell me about a farm in Ballymun?
Yeah, did you ever hear the likes of it? Ballymun, as you know, Derek, is probably one of the most densely populated areas in the whole of the country, and it's certainly somewhere you wouldn't expect to see a farm. And you know, at the moment, if you go there, you won't find a pig or a sheep or a goat anywhere. But that's all about to change. The Ballymun City Farm Project is an ambitious effort to restore the heart of a community. Already, the Muck and Magic Community Garden has sprung up on an acre of land right in its heartland. However, in the near future, this is going to grow into a farm. And unlike the one recently opened in St. Anne's Park, this one will sit in the midst of dense housing. So, intrigued by this idea and wanting to find out more, I recently met up with local man Stephen Hayden, a driving force behind the project. And just to let listeners know, this report was recorded before the present lockdown came into operation.
Okay, Terry, we'll go in here into the polytunnel, out of the cold and the wind.
My God, there's some breeze there today.
There is.
So here we are in your polytunnel, and it's pretty much empty at the moment. I suppose that's because of the time of the year it's at. If we move up here to the top, I see a lovely old, what looks like an old banana tree. It's just...
No. Canna. That's
canna, yes.
That's wrapped up and put away for the winter.
Yeah, yeah. And I just look at some nasturtium, the remains of some nasturtium.
That's true, yeah. I mean, this is a very productive space, you know, in the height of the season. There's all the tomatoes and herbs and all sorts, and there's a grapevine. So it's a very productive space.
So we're in Muck and Magic Community Garden.
That's right.
In the heart of Ballymun.
In the heart of Ballymun. And as you know, it's, I mean, you can see yourself, it's it's an oasis really in the heart of a very urban area, despite the level and volume of traffic,
which we can hear just banging away
just
behind us,
just over the fence. Yeah. It's a lovely little space, and you can see the various elements of it, I suppose.
Yeah, just run me through some, because I'm looking up there. I see what looks like a gazebo.
That's true. Down along here, you have some raised beds, and then there's the gazebo there, which is very much a communal space,
right.
in a kind of a little woodland garden, which is again a lovely space in the summer. On occasions when we do get an awful lot of sun, it's a nice shaded space to spend time in.
And behind me here, I see too a little pond. Is it?
That's true. Just behind you there, there's what was put in as a sensory garden. So it's a very accessible garden for people in wheelchairs, or it doesn't matter if you're pushing a buggy, it's still accessible. Yeah. It's a small pond and a variety of plants there that are, in terms of the texture and scent and all, are very much, it's very much a sensory garden for that reason and sound.
So we're in the community garden, but you've got bigger plants than that. You're talking farming.
That's true. Now, not commercial farming, I have to say. So we put people's mind at rest. We're not proposing to put a commercial farm in the heart of Ballymun. But what we are looking at developing is a city farm. Along the lines of city farms that have been in existence in the UK for 30, 40 years.
Okay, explain city farm.
Okay, well, the city farm as we envisage it is, it's on several acres of land in an urban area, and it consists usually of, well, in our case it'll consist of community garden, a productive community garden, kitchen garden on one side, and on the other side then you will have a mix of rare breed farm animals that will sort of, so you have the animal side of it and you have the vegetable or food production side of it. We would also hope in terms of the design we did, the concept design we have, that on the boundary of the city farm we will have a wheelchair accessible nature walk. Which is accessible to anybody, regardless of whether you're in a wheelchair or you're pushing a pram or whatever the case may be. And that will be planted up with native trees and hedgerow, so that it gives, in terms of biodiversity, it gives a really vibrant habitat to a mix of wildlife in the heart of an urban space.
Now, what plants and animals will you have on the farm?
Well, rare breeds is the focus, really, and that's our main focus, because there are a lot of rare breeds. There are few enough Irish rare breeds left, in truth. And I think the rare breeds that are left really need to be protected. And rare breeds generally, I think, need more focus and protection, because there's a lot of value and a lot of history and a lot of culture behind it that can be, they can use as a laning sort of process.
So I presume pigs and sheep.
Pigs, sheep. We'd be looking at pigs, sheep, goats, chickens, ducks, in small numbers. It's not, as I say, a commercial farm.
What size are you talking about then of the farm?
Well, we were fortunate enough to have the city farm included in the local area plan for Ballymun, which is the first time, to the best of our knowledge, that a city farm has ever been included in a local development plan in Ireland. And in the context of Ballymun, that is quite unique, in a very urban environment. And then a blueprint was commissioned by City Council, and that blueprint looked at, made recommendations in relation to the size and the structure and the location. And the size that recommends is a minimum of about 4.5 acres, up to a maximum of 6. I think if you go over that, then it becomes more difficult in terms of management.
Yeah.
And if you go below it, it really can't deliver the type of projects and programs you want. And there's another document I read where the City Council, in discussions with others, have said that it needs, a city farm to be meaningful, needs to be a minimum of 2 to 4 acres. Mm-hmm. So I think we're looking at around the 4, 4.5 acre size really to be a meaningful project.
And that's going to be just literally across the road from us where we are.
Literally across the road. It's a 13-acre site in total, so a portion of that site would be given over to the city farm. The remainder of that site would be developed for some sort of affordable housing. On the boundary of that site, you have a creche, you have a boys' national school, a girls' national school, and a youth centre. So that you would have this unique development of all of these, educational establishments, if you like, attached to a city farm. So you have this potential to create a kind of a really interesting, almost like an educational campus made up of creches, preschools, primary schools, youth centres and a city farm,
and
all
of course
in one location.
You could have other students coming in, other primary kids from all over the city.
Absolutely.
Coming over to see this farm in action.
Absolutely, and we've been very conscious of the name. We've deliberately called the project the City Farm Ballymun, not the Ballymun City Farm, because it's a city farm based in Ballymun. The location is Ballymun, but it's for the city very much. And one of the advantages we have, I suppose, is that we're just off the M50. We're on the proposed Metro North line. There are multiple bus routes crisscrossing the city from Ballymun to the south side, and the most recent being from IKEA to Bray. You have the number 13 and the number 4, which run right to the south side. You have two buses running across the north side, and you have something like 25,000 vehicles accessing the city every day up and down Ballymun Main Street. So in terms of accessibility, we're accessible to the entire city. We have the advantage of having about 130 acres of land which is freed up as part of the redevelopment of the area between the Ballymun local area plan site, if you like, and the lands they call M50 lands up towards IKEA and the M50. So there's 130 acres in the ownership of Dublin City Council, and the potential to develop something unique in the heart of Ballymun.
Because it is unique.
It is unique. Oh, it is absolutely. I mean, it hasn't been done before. There are city farms, perhaps, that are in rural areas or are extensions of a parkland, perhaps. But to build something like this in the heart of an urban site is unique in Irish terms, certainly. But in the UK, it's not unique. We visited a number of city farms in London and in Sheffield, which are very much in the heart of their communities. In Kentish Town, it's a city farm that's split in half by a railway track. It's surrounded by seven housing estates. And when we visited, the housing was literally built up to the boundary wall of the farm. And it's very much in the heart of its community and provides a wealth of resources and programmes and projects which are hugely beneficial to the community there.
And when do you hope to be up and running?
Well, we've agreed the location for the city farm. The next stage is the discussions as to exactly where on that site the city farm will go and exactly what size the city farm will be, taking into account all the competing interests that there are. But we would be hopeful, we're quite confident that with goodwill on all sides, we can make very rapid progress on the project, and we should be, hopefully, in a position in the not-too-distant future to welcome you back to the city farm proper.
Well, I'd love to come back.
Well, there's always a welcome for you.
Fantastic stuff. Good man, Terry, and good man, Stephen. Before we wrap up this evening, Niall, I want to draw your attention to another bit of audio we have. This has come from Claire Hardman, and Claire is the conservation ranger at the Glengariff Nature Reserve in County Cork. And they have set a webcam up spying, if you want, on some white-tailed sea eagles.
Hi Derek and team, this is Claire Herdman here. I'm the conservation ranger down in Glengariff in West Cork, and this week we're absolutely thrilled to bring you news of two new white-tailed eagle chicks who've hatched in a nest in Glengariff Harbour. The first one hatched on the 15th of April and the second one on Sunday the 19th of April. But best of all, to you and all your listeners, you can follow the action live because we have a webcam on the nest. And of course, with two chicks, there's plenty of action at the moment. Feeding time is the best time to see the chicks, the two little wobbly white fluffy heads. And at the moment, feeding is happening 10 to 20 minutes on every hour. Dad has been the main one bringing food to the nest. And so far, we've seen seabirds and fish. And actually, this morning, there was a live dogfish, which was squirming around in the nest. To find the link to the webcam, go to the Glengariff Nature Reserve website, glengariffnaturereserve.ie, or follow us on Facebook. And on Facebook and Twitter, I'll be posting daily highlights, little clips of interesting action. So, yep, I hope you all enjoy this really incredible opportunity to watch this amazing slice of Irish wildlife in your homes, on your devices, wherever you are. Stay safe, everyone. Bye.
You've had a look at the webcam, Niall.
I have. It's hard to take my eyes off it, actually. It's really entertaining and engrossing viewing. You can see there in the crook of a tree where the nest is, where the eagles are. Majestic creatures, I have to say. The white-tailed eagle, of course, is one of the birds of prey that was reintroduced into Ireland. It went extinct here, sadly, but it's been reintroduced by the Golden Eagle Trust. And they've been nesting in a couple of locations in Ireland now. And it's great to have them back in their rightful place in Irish skies. I hope that this pair have every success this summer and that they produce youngsters that manage to fledge and eventually go on to breed in the future as well themselves. It's great to have this bird back in the Irish environment again.
Well, we'll put a permanent link on our website. Yes, Terry, go ahead.
I just wanted to say too, they have a very special place in my heart as well, because as you remember, I went to Norway with Dr. Mm-hmm. Alan Mee and was on the flight that came back with those first 16 birds that came back here to Ireland, back into Kerry, Farran Four Airport. And I think that was 2007. And it's great to see that those birds are now breeding themselves and they're producing offspring.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much indeed, Terry, and thank you, Niall. And just to remind everybody that on Sunday morning from 6 a.m. right here on RT Radio 1, you can listen to the Dawn Chorus. It is International Dawn Chorus Day. Get out into your garden or pull up a chair in your favourite room and open the window. And as I always say, let nature in. It couldn't be simpler. Until next week, goodbye.
Dr. Livingston, I presume, stepping out of the jungle gloom into the midday sun. What did you find there? Did you stand a while and stare? Did you meet anyone? I see butterflies galore. I see people big and small. I've still not found what I'm looking for.
V Mooney Goes Wild, Curl Lore. Hey, Derek Mooney.